We are, since it's Easter coming up this Sunday, I thought that I would do a special. So we're going to set up a basic chronology of Jesus' final week before the cross. So we're going to work through a number of difficulties that people have surfaced. There are many others I could raise, but I believe that all the chronological issues and geographic issues are soluble, but we only have so much space and so much time. So this is probably a little different view than you've seen of this, so I'm not going to be devoting time to an Easter message per se, but we will work our way through the chronology and some of the geography involved in the time before the cross. I would not be surprised if there are some typos. I would not be surprised if there are some slides that are out of order in the process of setting my outline slides in there. Cutting and pasting, I managed a couple of points to have myself confused. And that's so I hope it's all straightened out, but if it isn't, we'll discover it along the way. I basically set up a timeline like a person would set in a weekly planner, indicating the basic things that Jesus would have set forth if he were working out a weekly planner there for the week that he was going to be spending in Jerusalem prior to his crucifixion. So, the way that I've arranged the notes, I have issues, and so each of those will come up as an outline slide, and then we'll deal with the questions. What suggests that Jesus went between Bethany and the temple each day? You'll notice on the chart that is at the top of your page that each day I say that he went to the temple and then ended up at Bethany. Well, the passage that gives us reason to understand that, one is in Matthew and one is in Luke. Then he left them and went out of the city, that is out of Jerusalem, to Bethany, and he lodged there, that is, he stayed overnight. So Jerusalem is just on the west side of the Mount of Olives, and Bethany is on the east slope. It's not in the valley, it's not on the floor of the valley, but it is on the Mount of Olives on the east side. Notice then that Luke 21:37, and in the daytime he was teaching in the temple, but at night he went out and stayed on the mountain called Olivet, or the Mount of Olives. I believe that indications are that Luke is treating being on the Mount of Olives as the location that he specifies for Bethany. So if you see Mount of Olives, it can refer to Jesus being at the Garden of Gethsemane on the west side or overnight in Bethany. So we have validated all of the things that have check marks because Luke indicated that this was happening each day, that he would teach in the temple and then he would sleep at night in Bethany. What suggests that Jesus went to Gethsemane each evening? Gethsemane, by the way, means a press for olives. Geth is for the word for a press, and then semene is olive. Well, notice that the Garden of Gethsemane is in between the temple and Bethany, and so Jesus would pass by it on the logical route to Bethany. But now note John 18:2. And Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place. That is, he knew Gethsemane, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Now, most of Jesus' ministry was up north, with a great deal of it being in Galilee. He would come down to Jerusalem for the feast, so he tended to be in Jerusalem for about 3 weeks out of the year. But as early as John chapter 8, in verse 1, we find that Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. I would suggest that he probably went and stayed with the family of Lazarus and his two sisters in Bethany. Furthermore, the petition that was raised to Jesus in John 11, saying, "Lord, the one whom you love is sick," that was talking about Lazarus, this clearly gives indication that there was a close relationship that already existed between Jesus and Lazarus, which requires that they knew one another. No indication ever of Lazarus or his sisters being up in Galilee. So presumably Jesus had met them during one of the feasts when he would come down to Jerusalem. So as early as John 8, Jesus is spending time there. But furthermore, when we look in the Gospel of Luke in the central section, we also find that in Luke chapter 10, that Jesus dealt with the two sisters, Mary and Martha. So we have check marks here that would indicate that virtually everything that is on the chart is at this point shown to be the case. But now we need to deal with, what about that banquet at Simon's house? In one of the accounts, it says that it was at the house of Simon the leper. Presumably, Simon would be one who had been healed by Jesus. And so he was known as a leper, although my take is that he is one who had been healed of his leprosy, and subsequently Jesus had further contact with him. Of course, it's also possible that he was someone that developed leprosy between the time that the accounts in the Gospels happened and when John wrote his Gospel, but I hold to a very early date for John, so it's not particularly likely that that would be the solution. So I would assume here that Simon is one that Jesus had healed. Simon could easily be either the husband of one of the siblings, Mary or Martha, or their father. We're not told who he is, but that's a possibility. Another possibility is that it is a different house than that of the siblings, although we are told that Martha was serving, and so it's not necessarily at the house that the siblings lived in. It could be at another person's home by the name of Simon, or Simon could be part of their household. Let's now look at from where did Jesus come in order to first arrive at Bethany, and then was it indeed Bethany that was the location that he went to prior to going to Jerusalem the first time? Well, one passage, John chapter 12, verse 1, covers both of those issues. Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead, and so on and so forth. So Bethany is the locale. We're told in John chapter 11 that it's only a mile and a half from Jerusalem, and if you were to cross the range of hills, which is actually known here as the Mount of Olives, if you were to cross the summit and go onto the other side, you would be in Jerusalem. But now notice the timeline on the lower left. I take it that crucifixion was on Friday. I believe that it is easy to answer objections that are raised from Matthew 12:40. That's the one and only verse that causes anyone to believe that the crucifixion would have been either on a Thursday or on a Wednesday. I am taking it as a Friday crucifixion in the year 33, so that would be April the 3rd of the year AD 30, or AD 33, excuse me. So the first day before would be Thursday, then second is Wednesday, third is Tuesday, fourth is Monday, fifth is Sunday, 6 days before is Saturday. So Jesus arrived on a Saturday, but we still haven't figured out from where did Jesus come in order to arrive at Bethany. It's actually going to be a fairly long trip. It means on Friday night he was not in Ephraim, which is the place that he had been staying prior to this, because he had a very long trip. He had a multi-day trip. It probably took him about a week to go the entire trip. So let's work our way through the geography of this. This, I am sure, is something that will be new to everyone here. So we're now looking at Saturday and prior, and then on to Sunday. On the way to Bethany, that is, from where did Jesus come? We're also going to say that Jesus took the scenic route, and the place that I'm going to argue that he came from is Ephraim. There's not much controversy over that. The issue of controversy is where is Ephraim? And secondly, not everyone realizes that we are told the route that he took, or pretty much the route that he took. The location that I would take as being Ephraim is Kirbet El Makatir. Kirbet El Makatir is biblical AI. Now you'll notice on this map that there is Et Tel. That's the location that liberals have loved to suggest as being the location of biblical AI from the book of Joshua. And they love to argue that because it creates all sorts of problems with the biblical narrative, and then they have no trouble saying, oh, there are problems here. Joshua is in error. But El Makatir has been on the radar for quite a while because Associates for Biblical Research has been doing digs there for a number of years. I had a friend, he is now deceased, that was a pottery expert that worked on that dig. Notice it's not all that far from Bethel. And so note here in John chapter 11:54, that's only a few verses before John 12:1, where it said that Jesus came to Bethany 6 days before Passover. Well, it says that Jesus went from there, that is from Jerusalem, into the country near the wilderness, that is near the desert, as soon as the slope starts going off down towards the east. It becomes dry, it becomes desert. And Ephraim is not far from where it becomes desert. And there he remained with his disciples. Now, I didn't put in here that we actually do have some indication of the chronology. We have in John chapter 11, Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and there's no specific indicator of exactly when that happened, but it obviously is a period of time before Jesus was crucified on April the 3rd. But in the rabbinic literature, there is an interesting statement which says that Jesus was condemned to death 40 days before he actually was put to death. If that is approximately correct, then it would mean that Jesus probably spent close to a month in Ephraim before he returned to Bethany. And there's no reason to doubt the rabbinic writing. I wouldn't stake my life on that being an accurate chronology, but there's no reason to doubt it either. So Ephraim is the logical place from which Jesus has made this trip. But now the question is, where exactly is it? I take it that it's Kibbutz El Makatir, that is Ephraim, and so just to the left of where it says Ephraim is Kibbutz El Makatir, that's the ruins of Makatir. This is undoubtedly the location for biblical AI, and very possibly is the location for Ephraim in the New Testament, as well as there are some other passages in the Old Testament that have similar consonants but different vowels, and that in about three places or so, the Old Testament also refers to this location, besides calling it Ai. Now, there's an interesting thing in Jordan at a town called Madaba. And so we're going to look inside this church at Madaba, which you can see that it's a little southwest of Amman, the capital of Jordan, just east of the Dead Sea. And there's something very interesting in this church building. The original building, the floor, was built in the year 452. So it's been there a long time. It's had a lot of destruction since then. Part of the mosaic survives. It is a map. It is the largest mosaic map in the world, and it furthermore is the oldest one known to exist. So this is inside a Greek Orthodox church. You can see all of their icons, their pictures of the Greek Orthodox. I've thought that the Old Testament prohibition on graven images, said, well, no statues, but it's all right to have paintings. So Greek Orthodox have lots and lots of paintings and so forth. This is a depiction of what the surviving portions of the floor look like. And so some of the key locations are marked here, and that with numbers, and then in several languages we have a key to that. Here's another depiction of this, and we're going to take a blow up of the section that is in the upper left. And so, one up inside that oval, it says Jericho very, very clearly. And then in two, it says Ephraim, where the Lord came. And then number three has within it Bethel. Now you'll notice that I have put an indicator of what is north. It's in the lower left. Interestingly, most maps today have north as their orientation. That is, you would expect, looking at a map, that that would be north at the top, but no. Most ancient maps had the east as the sun, as the top of the map, because they regarded the sun coming up in the east as saying, well, that's up, that would be the top. And so their maps tend to orient in at a 90-degree angle. So notice on the left-hand side, Kirbet el Maqatir in red. And then you'll notice on the right the map that I showed you earlier, and we have Maqatir, Biblical AI. Now, when one analyzes all of the data, that does work better than the location that has typically been understood as Biblical Ephraim, and that is Tibet, because the relationship between Tibet and Bethel, and as opposed to Kirbet el Maqatir in relation to Bethel, is suggesting that, among other arguments, that Kirbet el Maqatir is very likely the location for both Ai as well as for Ephraim. But now we're going to argue something else, and that is that Jesus took the scenic route to Bethany. He did not take the shortcut. Let me say what would have happened if he took the shortcut. If he went south, and this aerial map, as you're looking towards Jerusalem, that's basically south. So Ai, or Ephraim, to Jerusalem is about 9 miles. If he were to go east to Jericho, that would be about 14 miles, and then you have about 18 miles to get from Jericho to Jerusalem. So he could have gone south, or he could have gone east and then went southwest. Either of those would have been much shorter routes to get to Bethany. But starting in John chapter 10, there was a very active design upon having Jesus put to death. And in fact, at the end of John chapter 11, the Sanhedrin concluded that Jesus needed to be put to death. That is the event that the Jewish writings, the rabbinical writings, indicate occurred 40 days before Jesus was put to death. As a result, Jesus does not really want to go through Jerusalem until the appropriate time. He's going to wait until a strategic time, a time that was pointed to by the book of Daniel. We'll talk about that later. So I'm going to argue that Jesus took a much longer route. The route that he took, if you were to drive today by car, would be 172 miles. He definitely took the scenic route on his way to Bethany. He could have done so in about 10 or 10 and a half miles. Okay, you'll notice here that we have Bethel at the lower end of that yellow arrow that is on to the left. Well, Bethel is not very far from Ephraim or Ai. Jesus would have gone up the central highway, up the spine of the range of hills, and gotten up north, according to Luke chapter 17, verse 11, on the trip that Jesus made at Passover. He went between the border of Samaria and Galilee. Okay, he's a long way south, way down here, and he would have to go north considerably to get to the border between Samaria and Galilee. Let's see that from a different standpoint. Let's look. Okay. As I said, I very likely have a few slides out of order. I've got another slide in here, but we'll skip ahead here. Mount of Olives is in between Jerusalem and Bethany. So as you're looking east on the left side, you're looking across the Mount of Olives on the other side, on the downslope, but not in the valley, is Bethany. Now, on the right-hand side, you can see that Bethany is on the slope, and as you're looking west over that, you are now looking towards Jerusalem. That's Jesus' destination. So he went from Ephraim to Bethany. That particular day, he probably walked for about 15 miles, so he may well have started out from Jericho and arrived in Bethany that evening. Now, there's going to be a banquet. That's going to be mentioned here. And we need to place the timing on this. This is very controversial. You know that most people talk about Palm Sunday, and you know if you've been around me that I always talk about Palm Monday. The whole issue is, when was this banquet? Notice I have it on the itinerary as being on Sunday. Most people put the banquet on Saturday. They move it a day early. I will have three arguments as to why it needs to be on Sunday. And that affects the whole chronology of the time that Jesus will be here in Jerusalem during his last week. So we are now hitting the most controversial thing in this portion of the presentation. Now in John 12:1, we're told Jesus came to Bethany, and then it says, there they made him a supper. But they didn't have cell phones. They didn't even have one of these gigantic ones that used to be the way they were. They just didn't have any way of communicating with Jesus until he was close by. And so they would have no way of Jesus saying, I'll be there in an hour, and then they could stick things in the microwave and, you know, get things all ready. No, that was not an option. They didn't have refrigeration. If they needed to cook something, it was with a wood stove. Takes a little time to get things going with a wood stove, and so on and so forth. There is no way that Jesus could show up late in the afternoon and they would have a meal, a banquet, ready for him. When we're told that this is a banquet, we are also told in John 11:3 that Lazarus was one of those who was reclining with Jesus. The word is not to sit. The word is to recline. Jews reclined at special events like Passover and other important meals. It was not their traditional procedure for eating. That's one of the reasons that one of the questions at Passover that's asked is, why of all nights do we recline and not sit? The whole concept is that special meals were eaten reclining. Other meals were eaten sitting down. This is a very special meal. Here we have a big argument as to why that meal was not on Saturday. We're told in John 12:9, a great many of the Judeans knew that he was there, and they came, that is, they came to Bethany, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. Then in verse 12, the next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him. Okay, what this sets up is either a chronology of Saturday, Sunday, or Sunday, Monday. John 9 creates a real problem if this is a Saturday, Sunday chronology. If verse 9 refers to Saturday and 12 and 13 refer to Sunday, and it's Palm Sunday when Jesus goes to Jerusalem, and as he's going, the palm branches are spread before him, it would mean that great multitudes of religious people came out on a Sabbath. Not likely. They are religious observant people. They would not make a trip like that to go and then to have to come back in order to be able to see Lazarus on Saturday. We already saw first that Jesus had no way of communicating, I'm going to be there at such and such a time. It would have been difficult to have a special meal, a banquet level meal on short notice. They wouldn't know exactly what time he was going to show up, how they're going to keep it all warm, waiting for him, and so on and so forth. No, what we're looking at is John hasn't specified it, but there is a gap between the day he arrives and the day that they serve the meal. It has typically been assumed same day he arrived, the meal was prepared, the meal was eaten. That is not what happened. He arrived on Saturday. Then Sunday was the meal. Monday was the day that the palm branches were spread before him on his way to Jerusalem. I was talking about being able to make a supper and so on and so forth. Yeah, here we have a wood stove and so on and so forth. They didn't have refrigeration. They didn't have microwaves. They didn't have gas or electric ranges. They didn't have any of that stuff. That would have been very difficult, but there's a further argument. I've talked about Daniel 9 when we did a series on Daniel. I'm not going to go into detail on all this, but there's an important chronology of prophecy that is given in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. The passage, verse 25, says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be seven heptads, that is 49 years, and 62 heptads, that's 7 years times 62. The total of those would be 483, and it's working on 360-day years, which was how Israel kept track of years. When they had a leap year, which happened periodically, they didn't add a day like we do, but they added an extra month in order to catch up with the calendar. When we add the appropriate 7 years times 69 times 360, we come up with 173,880 days. The decree of Artaxerxes that meets the requirements described in Daniel of restoring and building Jerusalem that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, that the day that that prophecy was fulfilled, that the first 69 heptads came to its conclusion, was on Monday, March 30th, AD 33. That is Palm Monday. If we had Palm Sunday, it would fall short. Palm Sunday would not be the time that this chronology would be finished. Now, why is this important? How does this relate? We're going to see in a little while that there's a passage that where Jesus refers to the end of the 173,880 days. Something to note here as you look at this, at the reference to Messiah. He's called Messiah the Prince, not Messiah the King. That's significant. When Jesus came into Jerusalem, it was in potential for the people to rise up and coronate him as king. That is not what happened. What they did was they welcomed him as prince. They welcomed him as one who is coming in the name of the Lord. They didn't take the further step of saying, you know, he's supposed to be king. Shouldn't we be coronating him? Yeah, it wasn't the time for that, but it is significant that it is Messiah the Prince. It's not Messiah the King. Coronation, it is after the coronation ceremony is complete that the person has moved from being a prince to actually being the ruling king. It is on this day, this very day, that Jesus proclaims that this prophecy has been brought to its conclusion. And now he can be put to death. The prophecy goes on to say in verse 26 that after Messiah the Prince, that is after his coming into the city in an official way, which this is, that then Messiah would be cut off, that is, he would be put to death. He could not be put to death prior to the completion of the 69 heptads. Heptad, by the way, is a group of 7 years. Your translation undoubtedly says 69 weeks. Well, when we think of the word week, we think of a week of days. But in Hebrew, the word week actually just means a group of seven. And one has to ask, when you see a group of seven what's? And in context, years is what is in mind. So, here's where Jesus' proclamation comes. In John 2:4, 7:30, and 8:20, Jesus says, "My hour has not yet come." Or it's recognized that they were unable to arrest Jesus because his hour had not yet come. But on this very day, Palm Monday, shall we say after 11:59 p.m., when the 29th has ended, it's no longer Sunday and it's now Monday, Jesus says, "The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified," 12:23. And then 13:1 says that Jesus, having known that the hour had come that he was to return to the Father — he can't return to the Father until after he's died, he can't die until after Palm Monday has been reached. Palm Monday had been reached, so he knew that his hour had come for him to be able to go to be with the Father, to leave this planet. Very significant. All of these things are pointing to it is Palm Monday, not Palm Sunday. So, the banquet at Simon's house took place on Sunday so that Jesus could make the first of several trips to Jerusalem, to the temple, there starting on Monday, March the 30th. So now we're going to look a little more closely, a little slower at individual passages, but do notice all of these events, everything that's here on the chart other than the to be determined items, has been validated. There is reason for accepting this as the general flow of the context of this chapter. So the procedure on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and in part on Thursday is go to temple, go to Gethsemane, go to Bethany, then repeat process next day. So what have we established so far? Jesus arrived from Bethany from Ephraim on Saturday, March 28th. That's in John 12, 1, after taking the scenic route. 2, the banquet in John 12, 2 was on Sunday, March 29th, not on Saturday. 3, Jesus went between Bethany and the temple each day, Luke 21, 37. And 4, Jesus regularly stopped at the Garden of Gethsemane, as John 18, 2 says. So now let's look at Monday. Let's look at the itinerary and we'll get into a little more depth other than this that might have been sketched on a weekly planner. Now I'm going to ask a question. Which of these with the palm branches is correct? Did it happen at the temple as is depicted on the left, or did it occur on the road on the way to Jerusalem? You know, the issue here is when the Bible sets forth 1, 2, 3, we don't want to treat it as 3, 2, 1. We want to make sure that we know what the sequence of events is. So, triumphal entry, Monday, March 30th. The next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, he hadn't yet arrived, took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried out, Hosanna! Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel. Then, when Jesus had found a young donkey, sat on it. So, people laid down palm fronds, then Jesus mounted a donkey, then after that he arrived in Jerusalem. So when you see depictions of Jesus, of the palm branches being laid down in Jerusalem at the temple, they've got it wrong. We can add a few more details to this. If we look at Mark 11, 1 and 2, now when they drew near Bethlehem to Bethphage, and that's proper pronunciation, most people say Bethphage or something like that, or Bethphage. Bethphage is correct, but Bethphage is, if you look at the map, you have Bethany, then you go up to Bethphage, and then you go across the summit, work your way down, go past the Garden of Gethsemane, and then you come across the wadi and then into the city. So when they drew near Jerusalem, specifically, or more specifically, I mean, they're in the vicinity of Jerusalem, but especially the vicinity of Bethphage and Bethany, at the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples. You will find a colt tied on which no one has sat. Loose it and bring it. Now, we get a little further clarification. As he went, many spread their clothes on the road. Then, as he was now drawing near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works which they had seen. Okay, so you have a roadway that goes up and down, but it's gradually working its way down towards Jerusalem. There's a first summit, a second summit, and a third summit. And so it says he's drawing near the descent. So Betfage is up there close to the summit. And furthermore, when we looked at the other accounts, it said, in the village across from you, that's where you're going to find this man that, or you're going to find this donkey that's tied up. So the donkey was secured up there, up near Bethphage. Not down in Jerusalem, definitely not in the temple. And so the people are taking the palm fronds, they're taking their cloaks, they're putting it down on the ground, but all of that is happening a couple miles east of Jerusalem. It's not something that was happening in Jerusalem itself. Now, I've been on this particular walkway. If you look on the right-hand side, you'll notice that I've put a triangle there. The courses of stones are fairly level, so you can see what straight is and straight up is and what level is, and you can see that is quite a slope. It is quite a slope. Now, the donkey was secured there near the summit. This is as one is getting pretty far down the hill, getting in the vicinity of Gethsemane. But you'll notice it's fairly steep. But we're told in John 12:20 that there were certain Grecians. I do not take it that they were ethnically Greek. I take it that they were Greek-speaking Jews of the diaspora. That's the way that the Gospel of John uses the term Greeks. It's used of diaspora Jews. It's not used that way of Gentiles when one actually looks closely at the usage. Now, some people have raised the objection, well, why didn't he use the term Hellenist? Well, that's a good question. But actually, there is a simple answer. There's only one author in the whole New Testament that ever used the word Hellenist. That's Luke. Well, John is not Luke. And John uses Greek with the same meaning that Luke attached to the word Hellenist. Now you might say, well, Greek and Hellenist don't sound alike. Well, they do in Greek because both terms are related to Hellene. And that's so Hellenistes or Hellene. So let me point something out here. If you're going down this and you've got a throng of people and you're on a donkey and people are having to play follow the leader, because only Jesus knows exactly where he's going. Jesus is at the head of the pack. They're going down this grade, and those Hellenistic Jews approach one disciple and say, hey, we'd like to speak with Jesus. So now we have Andrew and Philip approach Jesus, and they say, there are some Hellenists that want to talk to you. Jesus gave an answer, and people have tended to think Jesus was rude. Jesus ignored them. Well, if you look closely at the passage, first of all, you don't see it ever say that Jesus didn't meet with him. But think about it. Jesus is facing towards Jerusalem. Everyone's behind him. Two disciples catch up with him as he's trotting along on a donkey. And they say, there are some Hellenists that want to see you. Jesus gave an answer to them. That is to his two disciples. What he said was not speaking in front of a large group, speaking with a loud voice so that everyone could hear him. He was in front, facing forward. Two disciples are trotting along to keep up with that donkey. They tell him nobody else heard the words that Jesus said. What do I suspect? I suspect that Jesus said, tell them we can meet tomorrow at 2:15, or something like that. They requested an audience. What they were saying is, when Jesus has some time, we'd like to meet with him. They were making an appointment. Jesus was not rude. But what is this day? This is Palm Monday. Remember at that one point when it said in John 12:1, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus showed up in Bethany? The day he showed up in Bethany was 6 days before, and lo and behold, that was Saturday. This is now Monday. It's 4 days before. Very interesting. On the 10th day of the month of Nisan was the day that the lamb would be selected that would be male of the appropriate age and without spot or blemish to be slaughtered for Passover. And it would be observed between that day and Passover to make sure nothing was wrong with it. And Jesus came and presented himself for the nation to take a look at him. And he kept coming back to Jerusalem day after day after day. The Passover lamb was subjecting himself to their examination, just like what Exodus 12:3 says was to happen on the 10th of the month, the 10th of the month of Nisan. And lo and behold, this is the 10th of the month of Nisan. The Lamb of God is being evaluated. Is it suitable for the sacrifice? Okay, finishing up Monday, March the 30th, after the triumphal entry, Jesus went to the temple. Then he went to Gethsemane, and he returned to Bethany for the night. Now we know the first one and the third one from Luke 21:37, and we know the second one from John's Gospel, that Jesus did this each and every day. So that now leads us to Tuesday, March the 31st. And again, we have the same basic itinerary. Go to the temple, go to Gethsemane, and then go to Bethany. So let's look here in detail. You'll notice that I'm putting up the passages where this is referred to. If I had had more time, I would have put those into your notes, but I didn't. So if you need to jot down the passages, you can do so. And by the way, almost all of these are in sequence. That is, this passage in Matthew will tend to be before the next passage in Matthew, the next one in Matthew, the next one. Same with Mark, same with Luke, same with John. There are a couple of exceptions, a couple of minor inversions, but each one of those has a very simple explanation, such as one event that was discussed was a short event and the other one was longer. So then during the way that they're set up, some you might have the same event overlapping, and so it's a matter of choosing which one to put first. There's really no problem here with the sequencing that's set up in the text. So, Jesus sees this fig tree from afar, and he went up to it to see if he might find some fruit, some figs on it. He came to it, found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he cursed the tree. May you never bear fruit, ever again. This happened on Tuesday, on his way in. And by the way, the way that we are able to determine the chronology of these passages is that usually in multiple accounts, all of these are recorded, and they're recorded book by book, generally in the same sequence and so forth. So it's pretty easy to determine on what day things have happened.
Why have you cursed the tree?
Well, in Luke, Jesus told a parable about a fig tree, and he said, you know, I've tended it for 3 years, and it's done nothing. And first for 2 years, and then I'll give it a chance for another year, and nothing happens. And so it was used as an illustration of the nation and its rejection of him. So it was this, I believe, was being used as an illustration of the parable. But now we have Jesus cleansing the temple the second time. So this also happened on Tuesday, March the 31st. The first time that he cleansed the temple was in John chapter 2. That is a totally different event. There are things that are said that are different between the accounts. Now, after all these things have happened, all of a sudden we have the religious leaders getting together and saying, okay, we've got to do Jesus in. One of the things that they end up saying is, well, we better not do it during the feast itself, because then that might cause riots. A lot of people have said, well, they didn't follow their own advice. Actually, they did. Didn't mark this in the notes, so if I manage to forget to cover this, it can come up in question and answer, and I'll tie it together with the other passage. I don't want to give it away yet. Those are the main events that we see for that day. Then he went to Gethsemane. He returned to Bethany for the night. So that now brings us to Wednesday, April the 1st. Go to the temple, go to Gethsemane, go to Bethany. So now, as they're going into the city, Peter, remembering, said to him, look, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered away. That's recorded for us in Matthew 21, 20-22, and Mark 11, 20-26. Then we have a series of controversies in the temple. Jesus' authority was challenged, parable of two sons, parable of the wicked vine dressers, parable of the marriage supper, render unto Caesar, Sadducees question the resurrection, two greatest commandments, the question about the Son of David, woe to the scribes and Pharisees, and Jesus' lament over Jerusalem. All of these took place in the temple. So I call them controversies in the temple. Notice it's covering a large span of verses, Matthew 21, 23 to chapter 23, verse 39. Mark 11, 27 through 12, 40. And Luke chapter 20, verses 1 through 47. Then we have the Olivet Discourse. So now Jesus is on the Mount of Olives. So he's headed away from the temple. He's gone across the ravine. And so he's now on the Mount of Olives. And that's why it's called the Olivet Discourse. That's Matthew 24, 12 through 25, 46. Mark 13, 1 to 37. Luke 21, 5 through 36. You know, the disciples were admiring the temple and so on and so forth. And so Jesus answered their questions, gave a picture of what lies ahead for the nation of Israel, set forth a prophetic timetable. That happened on Wednesday, April the 1st. So, since he finished up there with the Olivet Discourse on Gethsemane, finishing up Wednesday, April 1st, he went from Gethsemane to Bethany for the night. That brings us now to Thursday. This day we see changes in the itinerary. He's going to go to the temple, he's going to go to Gethsemane, but lots of things are different. He's told to follow a man carrying a water jar. They're heading in to the city, and one of the things that's going to happen is they need to observe Passover. So arrangements need to be conducted in order to end up in the upper room. Jesus had apparently already made arrangements with this man, so he said, follow a man carrying a water jug. How Jesus knew that at that moment that the disciples happened to be there, that man would be there carrying a water jug, that's supernatural. But, you know, it is kind of interesting. The disciples didn't have any problem figuring this one out because usually it was women that carried water bottles. This time it's a man. So you see a man doing it, he's the one you're supposed to go and follow him, and he's going to show you where you're supposed to go and where the meal will be. This is Matthew 26, 17 to 20, Mark 14, 12 through 17, Luke 22, verses 7 through 14. This is on Thursday, April the 2nd. Now, we're going to get into Jewish timekeeping. And there was an issue a little bit before where we were talking about timetables. And I said I didn't want to steal my thunder. What was that point? Yeah, someone's going to have to remind me when it comes time. But Jewish timekeeping is a very important thing. You'll hear most people say, well, you know, it was universal that Jews told time starting at sundown. Sundown started the new day, and so on and so forth. It didn't start at midnight like it does for us, and it didn't start at dawn. Well, this is not universal. Let me point you back to Genesis chapter 1. We have, on the first 6 days of creation, it says, a day, a night, day one. A day, a night, day two, and so forth. The way that time was being told in Genesis 1 was dawn was regarded as the start of the day. Now, it is true that for Passover and certain other things that it ended up creating a rationale for, well, why don't we start the day at sundown? And so, you know, between the Sabbath laws and the Passover rules and so forth, it did become common for them to tell time starting a new day at sundown. But the issue is that it was not universally practiced one way or the other. So I have two mnemonics, two ways of remembering this. Jesus, that is the Judeans and the Sadducees, start their day at the setting of the sun. Gopher, the Galileans and the Pharisees start their day at the rising of the sun. So Jesus and Gopher. Now, those who started the day at the setting of the sun, Judeans and Sadducees, observed Passover on Friday, April 3rd. Those who started the day at the rising of the sun, and all of this has to do with how they would determine that it was the first day of the new year, and Passover is on the 14th day of the new year. 14th day of the first month, so therefore 14th day of the new year. It was a lunar observation that needed to be made. It was a lunar observation that had to be made in the night. And as a result of it being made in the night, is the night the start of the new day? Or is it the ending of the old day? That difference made it so that Judeans and Sadducees would regard Passover as occurring on a different day, a totally different day, than the Galileans and the Pharisees. Now, let me give a little bit of background here. The Sadducees are the ones that are in control of the temple. But even though they're in charge of the temple, they encountered an interesting problem. And they had an interesting solution. The rules originally were that people were supposed to eat Passover in the temple precincts, that is, in the court of the women, court of the Gentiles. But then the numbers of people kept growing, and as a result, the original temple couldn't hold that many people. So they said, well, you can be in Jerusalem, and that'll meet the requirement. Then the numbers started becoming big enough that they said, well, we'll expand the city limits for the purpose of eating Passover. And that so you could be outside of what would normally be the city limits of Jerusalem, and you would be regarded as in Jerusalem. So that made it so that more people would be able to fit in Jerusalem to be able to eat Passover inside Jerusalem. But just like how churches will often have an early service and a late service, lo and behold, the religious leadership said, that's another way of simplifying it. That would make it so we only have to slaughter so many lambs on one day, and then the next day we can slaughter other lambs. Very interesting. So what this means is that the Galileans, who, by the way, were largely in favor of Jesus, whereas Judeans were more likely to be opposed to him, they had different times of observing Passover. So those who started Passover at the setting of the sun, that is Judeans and Sadducees, observed Passover on Friday, April 3rd. But those who started the day at the rising of the sun, Galileans and Pharisees, observed it on Thursday, April 2nd. The Lord's Supper, Thursday night, was a Passover on the Galilean calendar. Yet the next day, Jesus was crucified on Passover when the lambs were being slaughtered for the Judean day of observance. So Jesus ate the Passover meal on Thursday, and yet he was crucified at Passover the next day. Passover was effectively two separate days. And so Jesus could do one thing at Passover and do another thing at Passover. Different groups calling it Passover, but still Passover nevertheless. Now we have the times for the Last Supper in the Upper Room discourse in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew 26, 26 to 29, Mark 14, 22 to 25, Luke 22, 15 to 20, John 13, 1 through 14, 31a. Some of you might be saying, doesn't it go all the way through 17? Well, not quite. The last discourse goes through John 17, but the portion that was done in the upper room ends at 14:31. In 14:31b, Jesus said, "Arise, let us leave this place." And at that point, they started walking through the city and out of the city in order to get to Gethsemane. So John 15, 16, and 17 were said on their way to the to Gethsemane. You'll notice here people lying down on a triclinium to eat. They did not sit down for Passover, they reclined. Now, going to Gethsemane is in John 14, 31b through 18, 1a. At Gethsemane is Matthew 26, 36 to 46, Mark 14, 32 to 42, Luke 22, 39 to 46, and then the passage in John. Then we have Jesus' betrayal and the arrest of Jesus. All of these are on Thursday. Matthew 26, 47 through 56, Mark 14, 43 to 52, Luke 15, Luke 22, 47 to 53, and John 18, 2 through 12. I know I haven't explained this, but you see those slashes, the parallel slashes? That means is parallel to. Let's say in all four of these passages are parallel to one another. They're discussing the same event. Then we have illegal trials before Annas and before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. Those occurred during the night. That was illegal for them to have trials at that time because witnesses were not available. Jesus even told Annas that you shouldn't be questioning me. You should question those who heard me. And that led to a guard slapping Jesus in the face. Jesus said very calmly and in a very nice way, you're breaking the law. You have a nighttime court when witnesses are not available. We'll have more to say. And we have Peter's three denials. The Matthew ones are Matthew 26, 70, 72, 74. Mark 14, 68, 70, 71. Luke chapter 22, verses 57, 58, 60. John chapter 18, verses 17, 25, 27. Then crucify him. This is also Friday, April the 3rd. Matthew 27, 22. Mark 15, 13. Luke 22, 21. I didn't include the larger passage. That was an oversight on my part. Okay, implications of Jewish timekeeping. The Galileans, who were more favorable in general to Jesus, were secluded for Thursday night because they had eaten Passover. The imagery of Passover was the angel of death was coming. It was dangerous to go outside, and so they're expected to stay inside all night. The Galileans did not know about all the hubbub that was going on in the city. Now I remember the point that I was saying that this is all pertinent to that I didn't make a linkage to before. And that is, the Judean leadership said, let us not kill Jesus during the feast, lest there be a riot. And people say, well, they didn't follow that one. They say, this is during the feast. And there was no riot. But wait a moment. It was during the Judean feast. But the Galilean feast of Passover was over. And it was a much, much, much smaller number of people who would stick around for the seven remaining days for the feast. If you had three or four day trip you had to make, you'd come down here and you were cleansed, and then you took part in Passover after having paid your taxes and all that, you're in a hurry to get back home. They had no knowledge that anything was going on. And so the crowd that was selected to come in front of Pilate as the Judean leadership dropped Jesus off at the Praetorium, lo and behold, that is a pro-Judean, anti-Jesus group. Pilate was shocked, because when Pilate tried to offer, well, I could release him or I could release Barabbas. Well, Barabbas was an insurrectionist, and these people there in Judea did not like the insurrectionists. They had no use for them. So he was amazed that they said, well, let's let the insurrectionist go. Pilate could not imagine that. He knew that Jesus was popular. He knew that the religious leaders were jealous of Jesus because he had a bigger following than they did. Pilate could not have imagined that there was going to be a crowd that was going to be in front of him that was hand-selected by the Judean leadership. And Pilate got snookered as a result. Now, you and I have all heard sermons where the preacher said, oh, on Palm Monday, all these people are in favor of Jesus, and 1 week later, they want Jesus dead. There's something wrong with that. It's not the same crowd. Yes, it's in Jerusalem. Yes, it's only a week later, but it's a different group. The Galileans had observed Passover Thursday night. By this time, they're in bed. And it is Judeans that have been getting knocks on the door from the Sadducees, from the leadership, saying, you got to come out tomorrow morning. It's important that you be part of this crowd. We've got to make a united stand in front of Pilate. We've got to make him execute Jesus. Come out. Be out here first thing. Be out here before it gets light. It was a hand-selected crowd. It was a manufactured crowd. Okay. So therefore, the crowds that were gathered to oppose Jesus on the morning of Friday, April the 3rd, were anti-Jesus Judeans. But they were planning to eat Passover that evening. Remember, the Galileans ate Passover Thursday evening, but the Judeans, remember Jesus and Gopher, the different time systems. So let's look at John 18:28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas, the high priest, to the Praetorium, where Pilate is, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the Praetorium, Pilate's palace, while he was in Jerusalem, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. They had not yet eaten Passover. Passover would be that night the Passover lambs were going to be slaughtered at the same time that Jesus would go to the cross. This timekeeping system issue is huge, and most preachers mess this up badly. By the way, a very helpful book on a lot of this is Harold Honer, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ. He was my doctoral advisor in my PhD program. Okay, so here, you know, I've got at least one slide out of. No. Okay, so this should say Friday, April 3rd. Okay, so now on Friday, April 3rd, we have trials before Pilate and before Herod Antipas. One before Herod Antipas is only mentioned in Luke. But these are in Matthew 27, Mark 15, Luke 22, and John 18. So essentially, the Judeans had had their leadership, had had their trials, but they don't want to be tagged with having put Jesus to death. They want it to be the Romans that did it. So that's the reason that they have put him before Pilate. Pilate wants to wash his hands of it, so he tries to hand him over to Herod Antipas, who hands him right back to Pilate. Then we have Jesus carrying his cross, and that Matthew 27:31b to 32, Mark 15:21b through 21, Luke 22:26 through 32, John 19:17a. And then the crucifixion, Matthew 27:33-37, Mark 15:22-26, Luke 22:33-34, John 19:17b through 27. That again should say later. I didn't, when I copied and pasted, I didn't move that. But before it turned dark, they hurried to embalm and bury Jesus. Matthew 27:57 through 61, Mark 15:42-47, Luke 22:50-56, John 19:38-42. And Roman guards were posted Friday evening after dark. So on the Judean calendar, it would be April the 4th. Matthew 27, 62-66. But what happened on Saturday, April 4th? Nothing. The tomb is undisturbed. But then, on the Sunday morning, very early, stone was rolled away. Jesus rose from the dead. His grave clothes were folded neatly, and the head covering was neatly placed in its own spot close by. Two angels were present, and we have the first five appearances by Jesus after his resurrection. A week later, we have another, and then we have other of appearances to others. So we have large numbers of resurrection appearances, one in front of at least 500 people. And all this demonstrates that Jesus indeed rose from the dead. So we've had a quick overview of all of the pertinent events through this period of time that show that we have a pretty good idea of the chronology of this. I didn't cover every single event. There are a number of things that I did not talk about that show up, but all of them can be fit very easily into the chronology of events. What I plan to do next time is I will look carefully at the resurrection events and set forth my understanding of chronology of that. There are a number of intricate issues to be worked through there, but I thought that this would give a good picture that everything can be reconciled. Some things may at the surface seem a little difficult to put together. There are issues that I haven't talked about that are not difficult to resolve, but you know, it's taken us an hour and a half to get through this material, if I tried to get technical and detailed, we could have been here a lot longer. But this, I think, gives a good overview and shows that the chronology does flow well.